and welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. On the show today, our guest has a few suggestions for plants that may be a bit more outside the norm, but will make a great addition to your garden. With us in the studio is Alan Pyle. He is a horticulture outreach specialist with the UW-Madison Division of Extension. He specializes in herbaceous ornamental plants, but like most of our Extension guests, he has a pretty broad knowledge of gardening. So give us a call with your gardening questions. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Welcome, Alan. We're so happy to have you here today.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
And you drove all the way down from Green Bay, where you're based?
I did. My office is on the UW-Green Bay campus, which is quite nice. I get to drive by natural areas and through the Arboretum on the way to work every day.
I was up there in the spring when we were saying goodbye to Larry Mueller, and I was amazed by how beautiful the campus is.
It really is a remarkable resource. Mm-hmm. It's a great place to be, and I was lucky that I was already in Green Bay, and the position was to be housed in Green Bay, so I didn't need to relocate.
Perfect, perfect. Although I have to say, I was like right in the middle of all this beautifulness, and it started raining. I was a little disheveled for it, but that's okay. I like the rain, too. So tell us a little bit about your background, Alan.
So my background, I have a bachelor's degree in horticulture. I've studied primarily vegetable crops and a little bit about sustainable techniques, which was a new thing back in the previous century in the 90s. And then there was a requirement to take one entomology course to get a degree in horticulture. And I thought to myself, that's really not enough. I'm going to be dealing with lots of pest problems. So I went ahead and got a master's degree in entomology, studying biological control of the lovely imported cabbage worm, the white butterfly that flies around like it's got ADHD and it's got over-caffeinated. So that was a really good background for me. And then right out of college, I got a job at a large wholesale propagation greenhouse in southern Michigan. C. Raker and Sons, now Raker Roberta's Young Plants. About 10-acre greenhouse facility, 150 million plants a year. At the time, they were in the top 10 largest plant propagators in the U.S. So that was a really good position. I was able to work on doing research and marketing and trials. And then I did a little sabbatical, helped some friends out in Northwest Michigan with a 1890s schoolhouse remodel, which was a fun project. Worked for Jung Seed for about 4 years, relocated to Wisconsin from Michigan. And then I did a little orbit from there where I was the R&D person for a natural garden products company in Green Bay. And then my sister actually found the listings. She's something of a compulsive job search person, and she was okay. working at Michigan State University helping students find jobs and so forth as an academic advisor. So it was kind of because she had botany folks, it was somewhat relevant to her job. She said, you have to apply for this. There are actually two jobs posted, one for consumer audiences and one for professional audiences. And I, of course, interviewed for both.
Sure.
And so that was 3 years ago, last month, that I've been with Extension. It's been a really good fit.
Mm, wonderful. Well, obviously, your background is extensive, and I'm sure you're doing, you can bring a lot to the people that you're helping in the state and the people listening right now. So, like we said earlier, whatever question you have, I'm sure Alan can help you with it. So, make sure you give us a call with yours, 800-642-1234. You can send an email also, which is talk@wpr.org. And one of the things that we wanted to talk to Alan about was some of the plants that are maybe a little bit more unusual that we don't think about or we don't see. But, you know, it's always fun to find one that can bring a little excitement because sometimes it gets, you know, can get a little boring with the same old plant. So I have the list that Alan gave us, and I put it on our website. So you can go to wpr.org/gardentalk and And under today's web listing, you will see Alan's plant list. That's exactly what it'll say. You can click on it and you can see this, so you don't have to be trying to write all this down. So let's start with the top one, which is milkweeds. And so you have told us that there are 13 species of native milkweeds to Wisconsin, which was a lot more than I thought, and one more than what I've actually was able to read. So tell us about that, Alan.
Sure. So I think most gardeners are familiar, especially now with pollinator gardening becoming so much more popular. The more common ones, the butterfly milkweed, Asclepias tuberosa, and swamp milkweed, Asclepias incarnata. There are some rarer species that are really not commonly found in the trade. You know, it's not something you can find seed for, even with some of the specialists. Or if you can find it, there are plants that really are difficult to germinate seed for or tend not to thrive in garden environments. There's one species that's federally endangered, Asclepias medii, Meade's Asclepias, and apparently it is considered extinct in the state of Wisconsin. It was really a pristine, undisturbed prairie plant. So given the massive loss of habitat, it makes sense that that guy is struggling. One of the neat things about the milkweeds is that they have a lot of other uses just beyond being a good larval host plant, pollinator, nectar source. Historically, they've been used as fiber crops. There's fiber in the stem that can be used to make twine and cordage. The seed pods, we're all familiar with the little fluffy floss and the seeds floating away. During World War II, that was actually harvested. There were programs to get kids involved in harvesting those pods because there are some really unique properties of that floss. It's water resistant and very buoyant, and it was used to fill life jackets for soldiers and airmen during World War II. Many of the milkweeds, although technically they're toxic, there are ways to cook them to reduce that toxicity and make them edible. So the young pods, before they're fully mature, can be eaten, and the shoots can be eaten. Typically, this needs to be double boiled. So you boil the plant material, drain the water, and then use new water to boil it again.
Do you have to rinse those?
I wouldn't rinse necessarily, just changing the water.
Okay.
Personally, I really like milkweed shoots. You harvest them when they're small, maybe 5 inches tall, and they are kind of reminiscent of asparagus when cooked right. Really, really quite good.
Okay.
There's also some things with the Asclepias that you can do to promote their attractiveness to monarchs for egg laying. If you take a portion of the plants that are coming up, the shoots, and cut them back by about a third or a quarter, you know, just pinch the top off, in, you know, mid to late June, early July, that'll promote branching. And monarchs, it's understood now that they really prefer new shoots for egg laying. So that creates a whole bunch of new shoots. And those new shoots often also will have reduced predator presence, so that those little eggs and larvae are going to be less likely to be attacked by things that eat them.
I have not heard that one before.
That's actually research that came out of citizen science through Michigan State University.
Okay.
So in addition to having, you know, the right species in your garden, if you're trying to attract pollinators and provide, you know, butterfly habitat, there are some management techniques that you can do to really help to enhance that that benefit of those species.
Great. Well, that's good to know because I'm stuck with common milkweed all over the place, and they get so tall.
Yes. It can be a little bit more aggressively spreading than I personally like as well.
Yeah.
That's one that I prefer things like Asclepias tuberosa, Asclepias incarnata, and Asclepias speciosa, the showy milkweed, over common. I wouldn't tell you, you know, get rid of it, but it is likely to get a little bit aggressive. You may need to, you know, do some root pruning, pull out a few plants, do some of that cut back, maybe even eat some.
All right, Alan.
I do want to mention Asclepias speciosa, the showy milkweed. It very much looks like common milkweed, but the individual flowers are about the size of a dime. So it is a much showier species.
Okay.
Those large flowers are quite attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a good one. That's definitely one that I recommend.
Is that pretty easy to find?
It's reasonably easy to find with, you know, any of the native plant-specific suppliers. You should be able to find plants or seed. A lot of the native species, typically germination recommendations are they need a cold stratification period, so the seed needs to be moist and cool. You can do that naturally by sowing the seeds in the garden where you want them in the fall, or you can jump through some hoops and, you know, put them in moist sand in the fridge for 30 to 60 days, typically, is the recommendation.
Okay, great. What's the second one on your list?
The swamp marigold, Biden's aristata. This is a neat plant. It does have that cold stratification requirement, so you can sow it in the fall, or some folks, and this was the way I did it initially, was with winter sowing, where you're putting a container out, you know, on the porch in, say, December, keeping it moist, and then as the conditions naturally break that dormancy, the plants will sprout. And because they're in conditions that are giving them the conditions they need to germinate, they'll germinate at the appropriate time, which may be a little earlier than you expect, but that can be a good way to do it. Now, this guy is a tall plant, 4 to 6 feet tall. It is late blooming. It only just started blooming in my garden last week.
Ooh,
so one of the things that's really important for pollinator habitat is making sure you have flowers throughout the season. The early spring and the fall periods are really the most critical, and the ones that, unless you're really thinking about it in your garden, you might neglect. So yellow flowers, kind of daisy-like. The plants, as I said, they are tall. They kind of have a pyramid or a Christmas tree form. Lots and lots of flowers. Highly attractive to pollinators. I've had photos of a group of flowers with 3 to 4 syrphids in the picture. Syrphids or bee flies are really neat. One of my favorite pollinators. The larvae are actually predators, so they eat aphids. So they do a double duty. They help keep your plants free of pests, as well as being pollinators. this one also is really happy in low areas where maybe you have wet soil that a lot of other plants may not thrive in. They may suffer root rot problems, things like that. So this is a neat one. Once you get it established in your garden, it will reseed. It's not overly aggressive in reseeding, and the seedlings are very, very obvious. It's got a pinnate leaf that's very distinct. You won't mistake it.
Okay.
So you can, you know, thin it out or move it as you wish.
And these are native, so.
And it is a Wisconsin native, yes.
Yeah.
So definitely a good one. You know, potentially you can plant it once and then allow it to reseed.
Sure.
And enjoy it for seasons to come.
Put it on the back because it's tall.
Well, the other thing is this is another one where in, you know, mid to late June, early July, you can go ahead and give those plants a pinch, cut them back by a third or a quarter. That'll promote more branching and keep them down a little bit in height.
Okay.
Personally, being 6'5", I enjoy tall plants in the garden.
I noticed that. His list has a lot of tall plants.
Yes.
And next we have something that I have not seen before, but it is really different. Mountain mint.
Yes, mountain mints. Pycnanthemum species, which I just like that genus name. really, really fantastic pollinator plants. This is the kind of thing where it's not going to be, oh, there's two bumblebees on this patch. It's going to be there's 4 to 6 different species.
Wow.
All hanging out at the same time, not bothering each other because it's such a good nectar plant. The other nice thing about the pycnanthemums is that they are nicely fragrant and can be used as tea plants. They are in the mint family, but they're not mints that want to take over the whole world. Most of them are more clump forming. The species that we have native in Wisconsin is Pycnanthemum virginianum. And, you know, really nice plant, white flowers, clumping habit, that great fragrant foliage, super, super good pollinator plant. It also will tolerate some wet soil conditions, but across the board, all the species of the mountain mints are really also quite drought tolerant. And they're also hardy. So Pycnanthemum virginianum is zone 3 hardy. The other species, Pycnanthemum incanum and Pycnanthemum multicum are better in zone 4. Incanum, the name incanum is referring to silvery leaves. So it's got kind of a dual effect in terms of being attractive. The flowers are maybe even a little less obvious and showy, but it still has a nice effect. But these are super attractive to some really large beneficial wasps. These aren't stinging wasps for humans, Sphex species, digger wasps. And, you know, they're large, like 2 inches. These wasps, anything that you've ever seen in a horror movie or a science fiction movie actually happens in the insect world. So the female wasps will go out and they will sting insects like grasshoppers or other insects with a paralyzing venom. Then they'll take them back to their nest, lay eggs, and the larvae will eat the paralyzed
still alive insect. Just
still
paralyzed.
Alive, yes.
Lovely.
Fantastic.
Yes, lovely.
Great way to make a living. So
you're enjoying this a little too much, Alan.
I'm a bug nerd and a plant nerd. These wasps, you know, I understand that people sometimes are afraid of wasps or a little intimidated. They're so fun to watch. And the black ones, the large black Sphex wasps, are dark colored, but they have this blue iridescence that you can see. And I just enjoy watching them so much.
Well, speaking of wasps, let's go to an email that we got from Elaine in West Bend. She emailed that in the past 4 days, yellow jackets have been taking a nibble from the points of her fall red raspberries. And although this has happened in small amounts when the berries started to ripen, the yellow jackets are now getting a bite of berry from 95% of the berries. I'm sure she did this, all the math, right?
Yes, yes.
Is there anything she can do to prevent or stop them?
Yes. So that is something that sometimes can happen. You know, these guys are interested in sugar. Oftentimes it will be sort of overripe fruit that's starting to ferment that attracts wasps and other insects. So making sure, you know, that you're not leaving fruit that's fallen on the ground can help. Covering the plants with a fine mesh insect netting to exclude them can be helpful, although that means every time you're going to go out to harvest, you have to uncover and recover plants. Potentially, and this is probably more bug nerdy than most people would do, you could kind of follow those guys to see where the nest is. If they're yellow jackets, they're probably going to be ground nesting. And then you could potentially take care of that nest with pesticide product or personally, the last time I needed to deal with yellow jackets, I just used boiling water at night. Very safe way to take care of them. That would be the main recommendations there. I will point out that wasps in general, including yellow jackets, really, really are beneficial. In addition to pollinating, they feed their larvae, primarily caterpillars. So they can do a good job at taking care of some of the pest caterpillars that you may have. I've seen them do amazing jobs at keeping coal crops, broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, free from the host of caterpillars that will eat those. So hopefully, we're getting to the point now that pollinators are becoming charismatic. People will think wasps, okay, yes, they might sting me. They're not after me to get me. Maybe I can try to be a little more friendly to them.
Oh, isn't this the time of year where some of the wasps will, they're just getting hungry and they're going to start dying off?
Exactly. So it's sort of the end of the season. Let's get the last of these these larvae reared. Let's, you know, get some happy queens that can overwinter to start things off the next year.
Right, right. So there might be a little bit more activity, but be careful. Don't bother them. They probably won't bother you. Is that good advice?
Yes, yes. Typically with nests of paper wasps and yellow jackets, you're going to get in trouble if you stumble into a nest too close. Different species will have different range that they perceive as threats. Generally, you know, if you can keep a foot or two away, they're really not going to become aggressive and go after you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good luck, Elaine. That's got to be so frustrating. I've had that happen myself. It's like you see that beautiful berry, you go to pick it, and you turn it around, and there's a big bite out of it. So.
And I will add one more thing. If and when you decide you need to use pesticides, it is very, very important to use them properly. Pesticides are tools. They're not inherently good or bad. They need to be used properly. And that means reading, understanding, and following the label instructions. I know nobody likes to read pesticide labels, but it's important to make sure that you're going to use the chemical in an effective way, and you're going to use it in a safe way, both for your own health and environmental health. And that's true for organic and synthetic pesticides.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Absolutely. Thank you for that. Okay, let's get back to our list. We're in the black-eyed Susan area. There's lots of them.
Yes, and Rudbeckia is one of my favorite genera of plants, period, end of sentence. There are a number of really, really great species, including some natives. Great flowering, good garden plants, attractive to pollinators. Rudbeckia hirta is a Wisconsin native, and one of the reasons I like this plant is because it's extremely genetically diverse. Excuse me. So diverse that when you look at six or eight different references, you'll see it listed six or eight different ways. Is it an annual? Is it a short-lived perennial? Is it a tender perennial? Is it a biennial? Is it a monocarpic perennial? That means it flowers once and then dies. And I think the answer is yes. It's that diverse. Typically, I consider it a reseeding annual. And having looked and trialed a number of cultivars in my career, what I have seen is that more taller, more vigorous varieties, the things that tend to get, say, 2.5, 3 feet tall, tend to be somewhat more perennial, short-lived perennial in the garden. Breeders have had a lot of development on this species, expanding the color range, adding resistance to powdery mildew, which is helpful. A lot of times, if you just have the straight species, by this time in the garden, the plants have gotten powdery mildew. They get that like white fungal growth on the leaves, and then they decline quickly. There are varieties out there like Denver Daisy, which is a really neat one, which has a bicolor flower, that have powdery mildew resistance and a longer bloom time, so that they really, really look amazing in the landscape for long periods of time. I'm a big fan of these. I have them in my garden. I enjoy letting them reseed. The other thing that is somewhat new to the market with Rudbeckia hirta, historically it's been propagated by seed. There are newer varieties on the market that are propagated from cuttings or tissue culture plantlets. And when they first came to the market, I was very skeptical that that would be worth the extra cost. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they are. Some of these varieties are Extremely large flowered, very powdery mildew resistant, very uniform across the series, lots of different colors and flower forms. So keep an eye out for some of these guys when you are shopping. They really do make a good addition to the garden.
It's lovely when we know that the new ones are better than the old ones. So we're talking with Alan Pyle. He's a horticulture outreach specialist with the UW-Madison Division of Extension. If you've got a question for him about any gardening problems or comments that you have, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. Make sure you stay with us next hour. Scott Wilson, better known to YouTubers as Gardener Scott, will be with us to talk about how to preserve your harvest. You know, the stuff you don't eat. Right now, we are talking about some pretty cool, unusual flowers, and they happen to be natives, I guess. Did you realize that on your list, Alan?
I did try to emphasize native Wisconsin native species.
Well, you did a good job, because they are natives. And we have one more on the list. And again, the list is available if you just go to wpr.org/gardentalk. The list is available for today's episode. The last one is actually my favorite. And I don't know if I've seen this before. I probably have. But you know, you don't have too many of this color. It's a sky blue. It's called blue sage.
Yes. This one was new to me a few years ago as well. Salvia azurea. Azurea meaning blue in Latin. Another tall one. This is a perennial Wisconsin native. Zone 5 hardy. The nice thing about this is that it blooms late. It's late summer through fall, which is, as we mentioned before, a great time. Pollinators really appreciate having that nectar and pollen availability in late season. It's also got true blue flowers with little white throats. For a salvia, they're quite large, maybe the size of a dime. So they're big enough for bumblebees to get in there without feeling the need to cut the base of the flower and cheat and drain the nectar that way that they will do with some of the larger flowered salvia hybrids. This one is interesting because the seed doesn't need special treatment to germinate. It's quite easy, which is often not the case for many natives. I really like it. Again, it is tall, 4 to 6 feet tall. It's kind of a wispy habit. It's not really full, but it really is an attractive flower. And a lot of times in the horticultural world, the term blue is used to be purple. And that's just how it is. It's as close as we can get. But there are a few species, including this one, that are actually blue, really nice sky blue flower, very cute plant. Bumblebees absolutely love it. A couple of advantages is that it is quite drought tolerant, and it really doesn't need a highly fertile soil. So, you know, shallow, rocky, poor soil without a lot of nutrition, it's quite happy to grow there. Mm-hmm. And like a couple of the other plants I've mentioned, you know, if you've got a smaller space and you want to keep it a little bit shorter, you can do that, cut back by a third or a quarter in mid to late June or early July, and that will help to promote branching and keep the plants a bit shorter.
Mm-hmm. So similar to what we can do with some of the older Russian sage varieties?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. But this flower is a little bit, like you said, it's more blue than purple.
It is actual blue.
Blue.
It is actual blue. I will mention on Perovskia as well. The story with Perovskia, Russian sage, used to be that it's neither Russian nor a sage. Unfortunately for that story, it has been reclassified from Perovskia atriplicifolia, rolls off the tongue, to Salvia yangii. So it is not Russian, but it is a salvia now.
Okay.
Also a good plant.
Okay. Well, I guess I've always thought of it as a sage because it does have the smell. So that's where I go by my nose. So,
right. And it's in the overall family.
Okay.
but yes, now has been reclassified, which can be a little frustrating to people, but it's the taxonomy is now using genetic analysis to do really deep dives into the genetics.
Okay. Because Neil DeBol was here last week, and he was like, you can't even rely on the Latin anymore. So
There have even been family names that have changed. It's like, well, we're going to move this to a different family,
which is very, very
strange to somebody who's been, you know, for 30 years.
Yes. So it makes me very happy that I've never learned the Latin names. So now I don't feel so bad.
Yes. That is, that's my foundation. When I start talking just in common names, my brain shuts off and I lose it all. So.
Okay. Well, I'm here to give you the common names and Alan's here to give you the Latin
names. There we go.
Okay. We got a couple emails. Also, if anybody's out there has a gardening question, please give us a call, 800-642-1234. We got an email from Susan, and she says that she has a house in Door County on the northernmost tip facing north, and she has spent a lot of money on plants that have died in her garden where the soil is rich with rocks and cedar droppings. Any plant recommendations for pollinating plants that will grow there?
Interesting question. A lot of times it is not so much the cold winter temperatures mm-hmm. that causes plants to fail to overwinter. It can be soil conditions, especially soils that are heavy and tend to be wet in the winter. That can be very, very challenging for a lot of species and lead to just poor performance. I wouldn't expect a lot of heavy soil in Door County, typically more of a sandy area.
Yeah, she's got rocks and cedar trees. That's probably her biggest problem.
Yes. That's a really good question. I probably would look for, I have a couple of suggestions. You might look at working to incorporate organic matter into that soil, which can be as easy as just applying a top dress of some good compost or keeping that ground mulched. If it is a really droughty soil, you can have the opposite issue, where if you don't get good moisture in the fall to help that plant prepare, it can be challenging. The other thing is when we don't have good consistent snow cover. Snow is a fantastic insulator, and it's really the fluctuations between warm and cold that can be very, very stressful for plants when they're trying to overwinter. And that is something that we are seeing more often these days as we're dealing with the climate realities in the state. More extreme conditions, more weather fluctuations. So if you're getting additional organic matter into the soil, that's going to be good. And then I would look at things that are particularly drought tolerant and off the top of my head, you certainly could look at some of the more drought tolerant milkweeds, Asclepias tuberosa, speciosa, could be definitely good options. You potentially could look at some of the pycnanthemums. And the Salvia azurea. And then, you know, don't neglect the annuals as well. I know perennials are great. I love perennials. I was very fortunate for about 10 years of my career to only have to think about perennials. And sometimes I miss those days. But things like the Rudbeckia hirta, even non-native annuals like zinnias. Zinnias, if I was limited to only one plant that I could grow for as a pollinator plant, it would be zinnias. Mm-hmm. Super easy to grow. You can direct seed them. You can start them indoors or by transplants. Very, very attractive to pollinators. The taller varieties make good cut flowers, lots of different flower forms and heights and colors. Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm particularly fond of bicolor types. Probably my favorite variety is called Whirligig Mix, mostly bicolor flowers. Mm-hmm. So hopefully that will be somewhat helpful. It's always tough to answer questions, you know, when you don't get to see the site,
right?
Or when you've got, you know, blurry photos
right.
that don't show up well. But I would just say, you know, keep trying and
good luck, Susan. And, you know, look around to see what's growing there natively, too. There's maybe a reason why sometimes you don't see a lot of understory in a cedar area, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed.
Jim in Mauston emailed to say a couple solutions to get bumblebees and or yellow jackets to abandon their nests are by using cinnamon sticks or powder. He put a spoonful of powder on foil at the edge of the nest and they moved on. Have you heard of that one?
So there are some registered pesticide products that are based on essential oils. Clove and cinnamon are two that are commonly used, and they can have some repellent or even insecticidal effects. So certainly can try that. And, you know, being creative is often good. Generally, I don't like to recommend homebrew internet concoctions. A simple one like this is good. Anytime you've got somebody online recommending, you just put some tobacco juice or some mouthwash and mix it up.
Usually Dawn detergent is involved.
Please don't play with nicotine as an insecticide. It's a dangerous
yes,
compound. It can cause everything from skin irritation to you know, other effects. So yeah, I don't like those concoction mixes. But something like a cinnamon certainly can potentially be worth looking at.
Okay. Marilyn emailed to ask you to repeat the name of the blue salvia, and also, is it hardy?
Yes, Salvia azurea, A-Z-U-R-E-A, is zone 5 hardy. It is a perennial and easy to grow from seed. I have not seen that one commonly in garden centers as plants. It is one you should be able to find reasonably easy from an online native plant specialist.
Okay. And it's hardy, you said?
Zone 5 hardy.
Okay. Joanne in Dane County emailed to ask us to talk about two things. First, the burning bush, which is evidently not native to Wisconsin. Is it harmful to grow this? It's so beautiful in the fall. Why do we have trouble keeping it around each year in Dane County lately? Second, Gillardia, a blanket flower. Why did Joanne, her mother's plants in Crawford County come back every year and bloom for months, but she purchased her purchased plants, supposedly perennial, struggle to return every year?
Yes. So we'll start with the Gillardia. I'll talk about friendly plants before we talk about less friendly plants.
Okay.
So Gillardia, typically, there are annual species. And there is a perennial species, both native, and then there's hybrid crosses that are, you know, were developed for garden show and so on and so forth. Typically, Gillardia is going to be relatively short-lived in the garden, 2-3 years, maybe 4 years if it's really happy. It can reseed, and plants that aren't hybrids between two species are more likely to look like the parent the next year. This is one that does like well-drained soil, so if you've got a little bit of winter wetness, that is going to limit its ability to overwinter, so that may be part of the situation going on there. Gillardia is a really good plant, blanket flower. The perennial ones are typically at least zone 5 hardy. Really nice plants. I like them a lot as pollinator plants, and some of the breeding has really expanded the color range. You can get some oranges and bicolors, reds, as well as the typical yellow with a small ring. So right now, Wisconsin is updating its invasive species lists. And there are species, including many woody species, that are on the naughty list, we'll just say, restricted or prohibited, but Yes, so there can be cultivar exemptions primarily for species that are sterile, that don't produce seed. A lot of these can potentially become invasives because the birds eat the seed and the seed gets spread out throughout various places. Burning bush is one that there are sterile varieties out there. There's also research on how sterile some of these things are. And, you know, if it produces a lot of seeds and fruit, but and it's, say, you know, 1% or 0.5% of that seed is not sterile, that can still be a good amount of seed. So mm-hmm. that's one that personally I would like to see less use of, burning bush.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful, like she said, but we have had problems with it.
Yes.
In being invasive. So yes. You do have to be careful about
yeah.
that.
And there are breeders that are working on, you know, trying to make some of these historical good landscape plants mm-hmm. Available and non-problematic. There are ways to make varieties that are triploid. They have three sets of chromosomes and, you know, cannot produce seed. And there's some good breeding work going on. But, you know, that's one that I personally would not recommend. And, you know, I'm not going to tell you to rip everything out if you've got it, but you might think about phasing those out over time.
Yeah. And they've got, you know, those thorns. So
yes.
Think about that.
Yes,
we've got,
indeed.
Dave in Appleton has a question. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I would like, if you would please, give me your personal opinion on the Nicotina plant. I planted some this year. The flower only opens at night. I think a sphinx moth or something might pollinate it. How do you feel about it, and how is it to grow in Wisconsin? Will it keep growing?
Okay. So, Nicotiana, I believe, is what you are referring to, which is the genus of tobacco, Nicotiana tobacum, the smoking tobacco, as well as some flowering species. There are some really good ones that do have that nice night blooming effect to attract night flying pollinators. There are some interesting moths and so forth. Personally, I do like these plants. They can have really interesting flowers, very elongated, can also be highly attractive to hummingbirds if they're not solely night blooming. This is one that, you know, I personally might pluck a flower and touch the base of that petal to my tongue to get a little taste of the nectar, only do it like occasionally because there are some interesting compounds
oh,
in
dear.
That plant. But yes, can be a good garden plant, especially if you're getting into that whole night blooming or scented garden thing that is growing in popularity. You know, it can be a really nice thing to have growing around an area where you maybe sit in the evening or at night. You can enjoy the fragrance. Good plants, easy to grow from seed. The seed is quite small. Typically with very small seeded items, you're not going to be covering the seed. You're going to be sowing it on the surface of the media and then maybe just putting a very light covering of media or vermiculite on top of those seeds. Not difficult to germinate indoors, and you know, plants are generally fairly commonly available at garden centers. Mm-hmm. You can get a range. There are a few different species, but generally what you're going to see commonly is going to vary mostly in height and flower color, and oftentimes those are available as a mix.
Okay. And that's an annual, right?
That is an annual,
yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good pollinator plant, especially if you're looking at, you know, some of the night flying stuff as well.
Okay. And thank you for that, Dave. And like you said, the scent on those is amazing, whether it's nighttime or daytime. So Deborah in Racine emailed to say that she walked outside on Tuesday and counted 10 monarchs in her garden. They seem to be going crazy for blue mist flowers, which is Conoclinium colistinium, which is in bloom right now. But she said that she never sees this plant listed as a monarch plant. And could you comment on that, Alan?
Yes. So the blue mist flower, it almost looks like an ageratum.
Okay.
Which is a good monarch plant. There's actually a variety called Monarch Magic on the market right now. And it can be a good one. Again, the fall period is really, really helpful for monarchs. They need to fuel up before they do their amazing migration.
Mm-hmm.
Purple flowers tend to be pretty attractive to them. And this is another one where it's one of those blue flowers that's really purple. The other thing that I have seen a lot of monarchs on in the fall is some of the Liatris species. A number of them are late blooming and are just monarch candy. So in general, I would say things that are blooming in late summer to fall that are purple are probably, there's a high chance that those are, the monarchs are going to appreciate those. And it seems like, you know, monarch populations have been struggling overall for the last few decades, but it seems like I have seen more active monarch adults this season than I've seen in the last few years. So it may be that, you know, some of the things that are going on with more pollinator gardening and habitat preservation, including planting milkweeds, is starting to see some noticeable effects. But it is one that, you know, it's such a great species and it has such a great story with the migration and, you know, loving the milkweeds that, you know, individual gardeners can do quite a bit, even if they've got a small yard, in terms of providing good pollinator habitat. So I'm glad to hear that they are happy in your yard.
Yes, I'm very jealous because with all of those darn milkweeds that have taken over my garden, I had one monarch. So
I'm
a little disappointed.
I will say one more thing about pollinator attractiveness. Typically, if you've got clusters of plants, say mm-hmm. 3 to 5 of a given species, it's going to be more attractive than if you've got a single plant here, mm-hmm. A single plant there. So it may be that, you know, that plant has become more established and is a bigger plant, is producing more flowers, so therefore it's more attractive as well.
Well, that would make sense. I think that's probably with all pollinators, right?
Yeah, typically mm-hmm. for pollinator plants, you know, you want to be planting out in groups of 3 to 5 and then clump them around.
Mm-hmm. So before we go, if you had to select one pollinator plant to grow, which one would you suggest?
You know, I'm going to go back to zinnias.
Okay.
It's mm-hmm. so easy and it's so multi-use. Great cut flower. At my previous job, one of the things that we had was seed mixes, and we had a zinnia seed mix. So I had an excuse to compare that mix to other mixes on the market and look at different varieties. And so I'd have 200 to 400 square feet of zinnias, and the monarchs would just be dancing and swarming above it. And I was taking home 5-gallon buckets of cut flowers every week. You know, I think some people want to hear, you know, this great perennial that's super cool, but zinnias, man. Zinnias are really, really awesome and are available in such a range of heights and colors and flower forms that, you know, if I was limited to one pollinator plant, please don't limit me to one. But, yeah,
right,
I could be happy
right.
with just a garden of zinnias.
I have a neighbor who that's the only thing in their around their house, in their yard. It's the only thing that they have is zinnias, and it is gorgeous. So you shouldn't count those out. And they're easy to grow.
It's super easy to grow. And mm-hmm. that's big, too, because, you know, especially if you're new to pollinator gardening or gardening in general, you want to start with something that's easy and is going to give you a foundation of success to build on.
Right.
I think as gardeners, it's really easy, and I do this every year, looking at, okay, my seed order. And you look, it's like, God, is this that much?
Yeah.
And then you scale it back. And then you end up not even planting everything that you bought.
Right. True.
So I feel like starting small and manageable and building from there is the way to really succeed with gardening and with pollinator gardening. And, you know, that way you can expand in the future as your skills and confidence get better.
All right. Well, Alan, we've run out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us. And I'm sure we'll have you back again. And thanks for driving down from Green Bay.
Absolutely. Happy to be here and would love to come back sometime.
All right. Sounds good. We've been talking with Alan Pyle. He's a horticulture outreach specialist with the UW-Madison Division of Extension. And coming up with us is going to be Gardener Scott, so stick around for that. We'll be back after this edition of the news.
This is Lee Rayburn inviting you to join me this weekend. Our guests will be Dr. Zorba Pastor and DNR wildlife biologist Josh Spiegel. Zorba will dispense his friendly and wise medical advice while helping to explain vaccine hesitancy and dispelling the most pervasive vaccine myths. Josh will take us on a tour of the elk herds that have returned to Wisconsin. Hear the call of the wild from Wisconsin's elk on the very first Weekends with Lee Rayburn, Saturday at 2 and Sunday at 1 on WPR News.